Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, June 15, 2017. EAE authorities discover more bodies of civilians killed by men in uniform.
There were four male and two female. And the traces found skeletons in the neighborhood of Gimunu area. Time will come as we implement peace now when courts are set up to try cases of this nature.
And the chairperson of the National Dialogue Steering Committee warns politicians about interfering with the process.
The National Assembly and the Council of State. It is very difficult to debate the issues. Issues that are very difficult, some people will be strong and they will intimidate others. And so nothing, a resolution that comes may not even be respected by the executive.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Officials in Yei County say they have discovered the bodies of six individuals who were abducted from their homes by armed men in Gimunu village more than 2 weeks ago and were murdered. The bodies were found in a bush on the outskirts of Gimunu village east of Yei town. Daniel Friday Martin reports for VOA from Yei.
Gimunu Boma Executive Chief Maurice Modi says unidentified gunmen abducted the villagers from their houses 2 weeks ago. Speaking in Arabic, Modi says after mounting a search, villagers and police discovered the bodies of the six men on Wednesday.
We went and discovered their decaying bodies in a bush near Koya River.
Yei River County Commissioner Dennis Lasuba calls the killings gruesome human rights violations.
There were four male and two female. And the traces found skeletons in the neighborhood of Gimunu area. Time will come as we implement peace now when courts are set up to try cases of this nature. We hope that more work can be done now. More investigations can be done that can lead to how this all unfolded.
Yei County Acting Police Inspector Fikri Fati confirms in Arabic that police officers retrieved six bodies.
We went to the scene of the incident at a place called Mike. We brought all the bodies and handed them over to the relatives. An investigation is ongoing and I cannot finger point at anyone now until after the investigation.
Modi says relatives of the deceased buried the bodies in a mass grave at Gimunu Church. He says the murderers have caused fear and panic in the community.
Half of the civilian population in Gimunu area fled to Atende because of the rampant killings. As the area headman, I am unhappy to see 9 people from my area being brutally killed in only 1 month.
Modi says he has asked the state government officials to deploy more security forces to the area so civilians can return to their farms. County Commissioner Lasuba and Acting County Police Inspector Fati say they expect the police to apprehend the killers and bring them to justice. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin.
The South Sudan Army is repeating a charge that Sudan government supports rebels fighting to topple the South Sudan government. The Deputy SPLA spokesperson says there is evidence showing Sudan armed forces supported rebels who attacked an SPLA base in Gwek of North Upper Nile last week. A Sudanese official denies the accusation. Michael Atid has this story for VOA from Juba.
Deputy military spokesperson Colonel Santo Domich told reporters that the South Sudanese army has plenty of evidences to prove that Sudan's government is offering logistical support to rebels fighting the Juba government. On June the 10th, Domich says rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar, wearing Sudanese uniforms and using Sudan Armed Forces military equipment, attacked government positions in Upper Niles, Kwek, Gabat, and Kola towns.
The South Force decided to withdraw in the night and allowing rebels group to occupy Kwek, putting uniform of South of Sudan Armed Forces with all the military equipments that were in Kwek, with all the field artillery with all the mounted land cruisers with light and heavy machine guns.
Domich says that proved positive the rebels were being assisted by Sudan.
And again, if you look at the capability that the rebels is having or using during that operations, indicates that these rebels must have received support from Sudan, and this is beyond any reasonable doubt.
Domich says that after close monitoring of the rebel activity, it is clear that Sudan government supports the fighters with ammunition, training, and even medical care.
The senior commanders and then the leaders of the rebels are being harbored in Khartoum. They are living in Khartoum. They are operating from there. They are remote controlling the operation from Khartoum against the government and the Republic of South Sudan.
Domich says the Sudanese government has been asked time and again to stop supporting rebels and to cooperate with the government of South Sudan. He accuses Sudan of violating the unilateral ceasefire announced by President Kiir late last month and warned the SPLA will defend its border when necessary.
Our mandate is to make sure that the national integrity of the Republic of South Sudan is protected using all means available, but the SPLA will maintain, and as we have the capacity, to respond to any form of aggression against the integrity of this country.
Sudanese Information Minister Ahmed Bilal Osman in Khartoum strongly denies his government providing logistical support to South Sudanese rebels and accused Juba of hosting rebels trying to topple President Omar al-Bashir's government.
This is not true. Actually, they are saying this to cover what they have done the last month when the rebels come from the south.
Bilal points out that Sudan has been hosting South Sudanese refugees for months and would not allow them to carry out activities that might create insecurity in South Sudan.
Those who are here, we are just treating them as refugees or as citizens. So we cannot separate politicians from normal citizens from the south. We have almost 1 million here. But they know very well that when Riek Machar came here, we didn't accept him because he's an overt one.
In the cooperation agreement signed in September 2012, the governments of Sudan and South Sudan agreed not to host or support host rebels fighting each other's government. Since then, both sides have repeatedly accused one another of doing the exact opposite. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The chair of the South Sudan's National Dialogue Steering Committee is urging lawmakers to ensure that their constituencies participate in the dialogue. Angelo Beda says lawmakers should also hold the government executive branch accountable for implementing all recommendations of the dialogue. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
MP Angelo Beda from newly created Tumbura State says members of parliament are often intimidated by powerful politicians and military leaders. But he says that should not happen during the national dialogue.
You have the right stakeholders of power in this country. That is the national legislature, the national assembly, and the council of state. It is very difficult to debate the issues. Issues that are very difficult, some people will be strong and they will intimidate others. And so nothing, a resolution that comes may not even be respected by the executive. That is the credibility of this national dialogue. Are you going to implement what we shall say?
Mary Ayen Majok, a lawmaker in South Sudan's Council of States, the upper chamber of parliament, says MPs are close to the people they represent and can influence them in a positive way.
As people representatives, we should be also participating very well in leading the process also because due to our presence among our people, people do listen to us.
Rajab Muhandis is a Juba-based civil society activist who works for the South Sudan Network for Democracy and Elections. Muhandis says civil society activists can reach people more effectively if they cooperate with lawmakers in getting the national dialogue off the ground.
We can work together to ensure the dialogue is genuine and more credible, and that it responds to the aspirations of South Sudanese citizens around the country and those who are even outside the country.
Majok agrees.
If we support this initiative, I believe peace agreement can be achieved in this country. Our engagement here, I thank the civil society, because together with them, we should not work in isolation also with the civil society, since they are representing also the voice of the public, and we here from the government side also as people representative, we should work with the civil society. We are not in isolation with them.
Anthony Makana, a speaker of South Sudan's Transitional National Legislative Assembly, says MPs have a responsibility to help lead the way to peace.
You should be the one to spearhead. When they say we are going to your constituency, the MP should be the first person to raise their hand so that other people can follow.
Makana says MPs and civil society activists should work hand in hand to ensure the national dialogue is transparent and that everyone gets a chance to participate in it. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a blood bank opens in Torit. Find out more when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the ideal presidential term limit and why?
My ideal presidential term should be 10 years because it will enable whoever becomes president to be able to accomplish his vision and mission for the country.
4 to 5 years, because for that kind of period, someone will have had enough time to implement his plans, because, you know, development is a journey.
I think a 4-year term is okay.
I have to say 2 years. After the 2 years, we can see if he is good, then we're going to add another year.
To me, I see it should be just a life presidency. Just because when we give a president a term, there are certain strategies that can't be implemented.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Torit Civil Hospital is opening a blood bank that will store life-saving blood for hundreds of patients. Torit residents mark World Blood Donor Day this week by donating blood. But health officials say blood donations are low due to ignorance and negative cultural beliefs about giving blood. Dimo Silva Aurelio has the story for VOA from Torit.
Dozens of Torit residents lined up to donate blood at Torit Freedom Square yesterday during a campaign to stock Imatong State's blood bank. Some donors say they are stepping up because they do not want to see mothers and other relatives dying for lack of a blood transfusion. Student Sonia Osile Martin was among the Torit residents who donated blood.
I'm seeing the situation in our hospital. You'll find that the young children are dying because there is no one to donate blood for them. So me, I'm very happy to donate my blood because I know it is going to help somebody.
Another blood donor, Sabino Otieno, a Kenyan national, says this is his first time donating blood in South Sudan. Otieno says having a blood bank in Torit is long overdue.
I feel okay after donating the blood because I know it is going to help somebody. And I would also wish that Ministry of Health officials to be conducting it on after some duration. Given that now Torit Hospital is having a blood bank, I think it is wise for that stock to be there each and every time. So I will encourage the rest of the people, if they are healthy, let them also be doing the same.
Speaking in Arabic, Torit resident Alfred Okongo says many people have nothing to eat and asking them to donate blood is simply a mockery.
We have
hunger in this area, and if I give blood, won't I die? If they could be giving some food items after giving blood so that I can go and eat in order to regain the energy, could be better. But they are just taking blood without giving anything.
Health officials here say despite attitudes like Okongo's, they will continue to educate residents about the importance of giving blood. Dr. Juliet Ajok, coordinator for the NGO CODEAID in Torit, which helped fund construction of the blood bank, says health workers must fight the myths surrounding blood donations.
Many people do not respond easily to blood transfusion because of some beliefs around blood transfusion. like how you can pass on bad behavior to a person you have transfused, or sometimes when the person who receives the blood dies, there's an imagination that you are the one who has killed the person, or that the ghost of that person will come to haunt you.
Dr. Ajok says the blood bank will save many lives.
It is a great milestone, and also I think as a state it is also a great milestone, because the anxiety and the stress that surrounds blood transfusion will be reduced, because we have had the patients die, many lives are lost here because of the time lag you will take to get blood. Sometimes you get a unit of blood, sometimes you don't. And in many cases, actually, the health workers have turned into donors. So you find most of these health workers yesterday did not donate blood because they have been donating blood to most of their patients almost all the time. So I think for us, this is a great opportunity. And if the community arises to this call, and I think we shall be able to save many more lives.
Imatong State Health Minister Pascal Hevera Oduho is encouraging all healthy residents to donate blood, adding she has seen what happens when there is not enough blood for patients.
We are so grateful that you are able to come up with this idea. We also appreciate the efforts made by UNDP to have built for us that small facility there, which is meant for blood bank, of which we really appreciate.
Oduho says she wants to dispel the notion once and for all that people can only give blood to their loved ones. That is not true. Oduho says people should give blood without being asked. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
As the international community tries to reverse the consequences of South Sudan's famine and food insecurity across Africa, one expert points out that it is important to think about preventing future famines. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
There is consensus among humanitarian experts like Jose Graziando da Silva, Director General of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, that famines are totally preventable. Speaking at the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington last week, da Silva said in many countries around the world, populations depend on local farmers for most of their food. Even in conflict situations, small farmers will continue as best they can to cultivate and harvest their crops, which da Silva says is why donors must continue supporting them.
If we don't get farmers the seed they need, we will have more problems next year. It will cost much more to feed that population because we will not have the local production available. And what happens now is that we just distributed seeds in South Sudan. They ate it. They ate all the seed we gave. And we cannot blame for that. It's the way they find to survive. So if we don't come together with the relief and the complementary actions that will allow them to plant or to have their herbs back as pastoralists, what a pastoralist does if they lost their herbs.
To prevent widespread food insecurity from happening again and again, Kimberly Flowers, director of the Global Food Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, says one needs to keep a couple of things in mind.
One is you've got to get markets working. So in countries like, for example, South Sudan, where you have 80% of the population depends on agriculture for a living, in order for them to be able to sustain that and sustain economic growth, you have to get the markets working. The other one is thinking about sustained off-farm growth. So that means for regular smallholder farmers, if they have maybe more diverse income and they're not fully dependent on purely their crop and crop productivity.
Flower says another important factor is making sure governments respond to emergency food insecurity risk by coordinating with international donors, as well as promoting access to important resources such as land and water.
That one's a really big one to consider, because when it comes to climate volatility or issues that we're facing globally right now in terms of climate changes, we're really in a period where things are too hot, too wet, too dry. You see these climatic changes making a huge difference in terms of smallholder farmers and crop productivity. That correlates directly to the global food insecurity that we're seeing today and to challenges that smallholder farmers are going to have moving forward in terms of not only less natural resources, but also continued shocks.
A CSIS report released in February says a key aspect of preventing famines and food insecurity in the future is reestablishing markets and providing the infrastructure needed to operate them. It says low-risk microfinance approaches are often seen as the most appropriate ways to rebuild financial capacities among farmers. But large private sector investment in the markets is another key to promoting food security. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Lutheran World Relief, World Relief announced it will soon provide 24-hour life-saving treatment for malnourished children in the greater Upper Nile region. The Baltimore-based NGO is partnering with another faith-based group called EMMA World Health to run three treatment centers in Upper Nile where there is severe food crisis fueled by extreme drought and ongoing fighting. Carrie Tannehill is an emergency program manager for Lutheran World Relief. She just returned from South Sudan and spoke to VOA's Kim Lewis.
These are stabilization centers is sort of what they're called. And we're going to be setting up three of them in three counties in the greater Upper Nile area. And they're really going to be focused on children and pregnant and lactating women, since those people tend to be the most vulnerable groups during famine or a food crisis. And really, these patients who are accessing them are going to be sort of the most malnourished out of the group. They'll receive 24-hour care until they maintain a healthy weight and they're better. A lot of the patients who are coming in here actually have secondary illnesses like malaria as well. So we'll make sure that they maintain a healthy weight and that they're healthy in general.
So what are the biggest concerns in treating the most vulnerable, such as women and children and babies and pregnant women?
Some of the concerns are that they can't access the centers in general, which is why Lutheran World Relief has really decided that this intervention is the most useful, because in this area, there's actually only four stabilization centers that are servicing a really large population. So that's why if we build three more, then hopefully that'll ease some of the access to them. So not only are the people who are going to be using these centers coming from our partner IMA's clinics that they have already set up. A part of this project is doing door-to-door outreach in the community to make sure no one really goes untouched.
When will the centers be open?
The centers, I believe, are going to be open hopefully within the next month. The project just started June 1st, so we have to do some procurement to set up the actual clinics themselves. These clinics are made out of prefabricated materials, which thankfully are already located in Juba. So it's just a matter of doing the actual procurement and then airlifting them out to the sites where the clinics will be set up. Hopefully within the next month, that will be all completed and they'll be open and ready to receive patients.
Are you getting the cooperation that you need on the ground, given the instability in the area?
Fortunately, Lutheran World Relief and its partner, IMA World Health, is already working in that area. So they're quite entrenched. You know, we can't say for definite, but for right now, there is pretty extensive cooperation going on. Anything can happen in South Sudan. It's just the nature of working in a complex humanitarian crisis. But for now, we're quite hopeful that there shouldn't be any interruptions.
How many people will these centers serve total?
So total during the length of the project, which runs from June until the end of September, we're hoping to reach about 90,000 people.
I understand that you all also will have outpatient services. Can you tell us about these services?
This sort of goes back to the other clinics that IMA is currently running. One of the things that we'll be doing in addition to creation of these stabilization centers is also a pretty large purchase of medication. Medication is really hard to get funding for, unfortunately. So this is one of the ways that we're able to fill a gap and hopefully purchase a big bulk order of medication that is not only going to help with nutrition needs, but also things like malaria and other chronic diseases that are affecting these people, which is making them even more sick.
That's Kerry Tannehill, an emergency program manager with the Lutheran World Relief. She spoke to VOA's Kim Lewis from Baltimore, Maryland. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Yei County officials discovered six more bodies yesterday. Men and women were abducted from their homes by armed men in Jimunu village more than 2 weeks ago and were found brutally murdered. They were found in a bush just outside Jimunu, east of Yei Town. Nine bodies in total have been recovered this past week. Jimunu Executive Chief Morris Modi says the gunmen have not been identified. Police are investigating. Modi says the deceased were buried in a mass grave. The South Sudan Army is once again accusing the Sudan government of supporting rebels fighting to overthrow the South Sudan government. The deputy SPLA spokesperson says there's solid evidence indicating Sudan armed forces supported rebels who attacked an SPLA base in Kuek of northern Upper Nile last week. A Sudanese official denies the accusation. And finally, a co-chairperson of South Sudan's National Dialogue Steering Committee is urging lawmakers to ensure that their constituents participate in the dialogue. Angelo Beda says lawmakers should also hold the government's executive branch accountable for implementing all recommendations that come out of the dialogue. MP Angelo Beda from Tambura in the former Western Equatoria state says members of parliament are often intimidated by powerful politicians and military leaders, but says that should not happen during the national dialogue. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Seasons of Peace by WJ.
Now and forever.
So, is it good?
Yeah.
We have been listening to WJ with the song Seasons of Peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Amukin kitu ya zaman sokumbi kun fok